All right, so we're in Acts chapter 27. Before we jump into the chapter, if you remember, who wrote the book of Acts? Luke. It's supposed that Luke did it. It seems to be the most evidence that supports that. There are a couple other thoughts, but that seems to be the prevailing thought. So if we keep that in mind, it's an interesting concept because Luke seems to be a really good historian, great with detail, and he seems to put in some items that really just are like, if you read through it, you're like, what is the point of that? You know, he seems to put in these minute details that it's just like, really, this could not be made up. Who puts these little details in here that don't really matter? But it's interesting. It's good. It's a good story. It's very detailed. Chapter 27 deals with the beginning of his voyage to Rome. You can call it another journey if you will, but this is more under arrest when he's appealing to Caesar as a Roman citizen. Let's see here. Yeah, and so it looks like we're going to start out in Caesarea. So if you look at on your map, we're starting out in the Middle Eastern area there, and then follow the arrows around, and we'll pick it up. Some things to keep in mind, it's really neat. As he's going to Rome, it's very detailed. Like I said, Luke does a really good job of it. And it's so detailed that not a lot of people argue that this is a true account. You know, some scholars, they'll say, did that really happen, or different things. But this is so detailed, and it hits all these cities on a traditional, on a traditional route, maybe not for this purpose, but on a good route through the seas, that it just makes sense that this is a true account, and not a lot of people, you know, disagree that this is what happened. So it's kind of a neat little thing that Luke put so many details in there, and it's so detailed we can map the course on a map, because it just picks out all the cities along the way. So it's pretty neat. Let's keep that in mind as we go through it. So, okay, Acts chapter 27, let's start off here. It says, "And when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment." All right, first thing to remember here, we see the author starting to use the we term. Just lost the grammar term. Is it pronoun? We concept, pronoun, which indicates Luke is back with Paul through these events. Not that maybe he wasn't necessarily with him since his last we reference, but maybe now he's directly with him since he's being arrested. Maybe they had some split time there. Luke would no doubt be with him on this now. And as it says there, well, it doesn't say there, but they're definitely going to start their journey from Caesarea. We'll see here in a minute that they'll get a certain ship from another region. But there's no doubt that they'll leave from Caesarea. Most scholars agree with that, or else Luke would have put a different departure area. And he gets put into the hands of a guy named Julius, a centurion. I'm sure we know what this is. It's a leader, right, of some type of Roman regiment or different things. Generally, they started out being a leader of 100 men. It may have moved to 80 men some period in history. I'm not 100% sure, and the name just stuck. But centurions, century for 100. So they were a leader of 100 men. It's interesting that this guy here would have most likely been part of a group called the Speculators, something like that. Speculators. It's an interesting term, interesting group. It was a special body of maybe imperial guards. They're not part of any specific division of the Roman or the Arman legions. They would have been tasked with different specific tasks, like maybe spies or policing things or different judicial matters, even executions sometimes, and then also prison transporters. Those guys are called speculators. You can look them up on any old website, but just this unique group of people. So maybe not necessarily part of a normal regiment or normal legion in the army, but more of a specific task for this types of purposes. Verse 2, so entering a ship of Adramyttum, let's go with that. We put to sea, meaning to sail along the coast of Asia. Aristarchus, let's go with that. Aristarchus, that's fine. Of Macedonia of Thessalonica was with us. So they most likely departed from Caesarea. If you look on your map, Adramyttum is up there, kind of on the western side of Turkey there. Do you see that? Kind of a little dot up there. It means a ship from that region. You know, some pose that he's actually leaving from that area. Doesn't seem likely, just that the ship is from that area. So that's the reference that's being made there. It's interesting to note that the usual route for imperial ships would have been sailing first to Alexandria down here on the Horn of Africa, the tip of Africa down here, and then over to Rome through that route. As we see, because of the timing of the year, he seems to be taking a different route, trying to stay through the coastal regions, trying to have shelter from the lands and different things, because winds would be contrary to them. And we'll see that here in a minute. It's speculation. We mentioned Luke would be here. It's speculation that Luke was actually assisting Paul, maybe his personal physician. We know that Luke would have been there, and also this Aristarchus guy, probably one of Paul's servants or, you know, helpers along his journey. There's two references, scripture references, that show that these men would have been with him. If you look at Colossians 4 and verse 10 and Philemon verse 24. Those two references point to these people being with Paul, but the only assumption that's being made is that those two letters are coming from Rome. If you remember, those are the prison epistles, and we said that that's likely he wrote those while in prison in Rome, but some people speculate that he wasn't in Rome when he wrote that. So there is the assumption that he was in Rome, and that's what the church believes and what we've interpreted for a while, and that's why we believe Luke and Aristarchus were actually with him. Verse 3, and the next day we landed at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. So if you keep following your map, Sidon is approximately 70 miles north of Caesarea. They kind of go along the course there, or along the coast, about 70 miles north. And he was given some freedom. It's an interesting concept. As we see through this chapter, Paul seems to have a decent relationship with his arresters. He's given freedom. It could be an indication that Festus, the governor before, if you remember Festus working with Paul or, you know, going through the court system against Paul, it could have been that he told Julius to treat Paul kindly. If you remember where we kind of left off about these concepts with King Agrippa and different things, saying that they probably would have let Paul go free if he didn't appeal to Caesar. So it seems to be some good relationships there, good examples Paul's giving for them. Although he would be free to go around, as it says, there's no doubt there would have been a soldier with him. Somebody still attached to him because that was part of Roman law, that they needed to make sure that their prisoner would not get away. Verse 4, when we had put to sea from there, we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. So like we were talking about, it's a little bit different than a normal route for this travel. And so they try to stick to the coastal areas, most likely to be more in favor with these winds that are against them. It says, because the winds were contrary. So they're going up towards Cyprus, if you see, or back around Cyprus to kind of make sure that they can get against those winds. Most likely, those winds would be coming from the northwest down to the southeast in this time of the year, avoiding those prevailing westerly winds. An interesting note, this could have taken several days to get to this little portion because the wind was so contrary to them. Verse 5, and when we had sailed over the sea, which is off Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city in Lycia. If we're following along, that's kind of at the bottom of Turkey there, kind of going around the coastal region. There's Myra, and then we have a spot where they take a break, right there on the bottom of Turkey, if we're following along on the map. I guess modern-day Turkey. It says, over the sea, which is off. That's another way of saying across the open sea, off the coast of. So they're kind of just staying along the coast. That's how we're able to chart that route. The southern area of Asia Minor. Some say that this journey right here, this little arc all the way to Myra, would have took 15 days because of the winds were so contrary. Those are some sources that say that. Verse 6, there the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy, and he put us on board. It's interesting, this ship would have been a pretty large ship. As we look later on in the chapter, verses 37 and 38 shows how many people were on board, around 270-ish. So this would have been a pretty big ship. Not unlikely in the time, the ship most likely was some type of grain ship or some type of commerce ship of its sort, moving grain and back and forth through the sea. Verse 7, when we had sailed slowly many days and arrived with difficulty off of Cnidus, the wind not permitting us to proceed, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmone. It's interesting to note the distances there between Myra and Cnidus was about approximately 130 miles. It's normally covered over 1 to 2 days, but most likely it was going to take them longer because of those because of the winds that are against them. It said they were going for many days, and they arrived with difficulty off the coast of it. So a strong wind would have been stopping them And then as they depart, strong winds would have stopped them. Maybe they would have kept going up this coast. I'm not sure their route they would have maybe been planning. There's a lot of different islands in there between that strait there. So I'm not sure if they would have normally chose that route or not. But nevertheless, because of strong winds, they're definitely heading down south to go across Crete there. All right, verse 8. Passing it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens near the city of Lycia. So they kept moving along the coast there on the bottom of Crete there, the little island in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. Some sources put Fair Haven on one side or the other of Lycia, but on our map there, it looks like it's to the west. And they go ahead and stay, and they port in a place called Fair Havens. Verses 9 and 10, now when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, Paul advised them saying, men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also our lives. This reference to the fast is universally recognized as the Day of Atonement. I couldn't find a scholar or a source that said it wasn't the Day of Atonement. Here Luke is using a holy day is another timestamp, so it's a pretty interesting reference. In the autumn, this would have most likely been in the fall, we know that. In the time in the year, it would have likely been around October 6th. And so this would have been a very treacherous time to travel through the seas, and that's why they're probably taking this unusual route. And some of the difficulty we'll see them go through and that they'll have an impact on them is because of so late in the year. It would have thought impossible to make this type of trip past November. That would have been an impossible thing. So we're into October most likely in this year, because this probably happened in the year anywhere between 59 to 61, depending on how you're going to count the reckoning of what's going on. But nevertheless, it's in the autumn, after the Day of Atonement, as we see. It's interesting, though, that we see some of the dialogue that's going back and forth. You know, even though he's a prisoner, he's still treated as someone that's very knowledgeable, someone that has a good presence with his captors and somebody that's wise or someone that they're actually seeking advice from. Not in this instance. They seem to go against his advice, and they'll end up shipping out nevertheless. But it says there in verse 11, nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than the things spoken by Paul. That's an interesting concept because the centurion seems to be making the decisions, which tends to lead to the conclusion that this was most likely an imperial fleet or a ship, not necessarily a private vessel. Because if it was a private vessel, the owner or the captain or how it says here, the helmsman or the owner would have probably made the decision. But here we see the centurion making the decisions on the ship. Verse 12, and because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised to set sail from there also, if by any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete opening toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there. So that would have been a larger harbor, larger and more traditional to stay in port for the winter. Where they were at in Fair Havens was not a good port for winter. And so they were advising, we need to push on and make it to Phoenix. But unfortunately, they actually don't make it. Okay, verse 13. When the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their desire, putting out to sea, they sailed close by Crete. So they got a little reprieve from the winds, and they tried to make that approximate 40 miles to Phoenix. But not long after, a tempestuous headwind arose called Euroxidon. So when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive. That's an interesting remark. So this is actually a very strong wind. The thing that they're referring to as Euroxidon is a mixture, it's a hybrid word from the Greek euros, meaning east wind, and the Latin aquilio, meaning north wind. So this would have been really familiar with what we call a northeastern wind. You know, this would have most likely been a hurricane-type wind, some type of hurricane-type storm, a very large storm. So it's going to stop their ship and not let them progress to that wintering harbor that they'd like to go to. So this would have been coming forth from the northwestern area and pushing them and stopping them from going to Phoenix. All right, so this would have been something to keep in mind. It's a very strong storm, though. Verse 16, and running under the shelter of an island called Claudia, we secured the skiff with difficulty. All right, this one here, Luke actually mentions we. So he's kind of pressed into the service of trying to get this skiff secured. It would have been likely that the skiff, like some type of dinghy or a lifeboat, something for security or, you know, if you get into some trouble, would have been on the side of the ship. And that would have been trouble, that would have had given them trouble during these storms to maneuver the boat. And so they had to try to secure this little boat inside their bigger ship. So they bring it up over the edge and they try to tie it down inside the ship itself. Merchant vessels frequently kept a small rowboat tied to the stern. So because the storm came so suddenly on them, you know, they had that little reprieve. Since the storm came so suddenly on them, they had to quickly try to seize that boat and bring it inside. Acts 27 and verse 17. When they had taken aboard, they used cables to undergird the ship, and fearing lest they should run aground on the Syrtis sands, they struck sail and so were driven. This is an interesting phrase, these used cables to undergird the ship. This is a unique Greek phrase. I won't spell it or say it, but it's a unique one that is tied only to, sailing. I was looking for an M word, I just lost it. Well, nautical, yeah. It's a term relating to sailing or nautical in ancient times. So some of the scholars have missed some of this meaning here, but some of the different commentators and stuff will refer to several different procedures that could be used to strengthen the vessels. So maybe they would have passed ropes or cables or chains under the ship, securing them on the deck above to kind of reinforce the hull. So if you're familiar with what's going on, if you got a ship that has a bunch of boards parallel like that, maybe they're tying ropes, you know, like this, underneath the hull to try to strengthen the wood around it. That could have been one of the procedures that are happening. I joked with Mr. Myers this morning, I was talking, I'm not very familiar with ships. I don't know, do we have any sailors here or different people that are familiar with this stuff? Oh, perfect, we're all in the same boat then. All right. No, but I was talking, I said, would somebody have to like jump over and swim underneath? I was like, I wouldn't want that job. He said, well, they could have just threw the rope in and then the boat just passing over it. But I said, man, I wouldn't have made it. I would have been throwing my guys overboard to try to swim underneath. But nevertheless, this could have been one of the procedures, tying the wood together to strengthen the hull. Another one would have been tying ropes around the ship's hull above the water for the same purpose. I'm not exactly sure how that one would work. Maybe, I mean, because tying ropes around that way above the water doesn't quite seem engineeringly strengthen it because the boards are going this way. You'd want to do rope perpendicular to it to strengthen those. So I'm not exactly sure that method, but either way, they would have done some type of method to try to strengthen the ship's hull. So the main point of all this is a crazy storm that they're going into. Very strong, hurricane-like winds. And so they struck sail. So they lowered their sea anchor, they lowered the gear, perhaps mainsail. They kind of put everything down and just let her try to ride out the storm. Verse 18, and because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship. So they began to throw over their cargo. They began to start throwing different grain or different boxes. We'll see here in a little bit that they'll start throwing over their extra equipment because it would have been nearly impossible to keep bailing out the water as best as possible through this storm. So they start to try to make the ship as light as possible. What that's also going to do is try to help the ship from running aground. If they start getting blown into unknown islands and it starts getting shorter depths of water, the boat's going to hopefully not run aground in that area and then get ripped apart in the storm. So they start throwing everything overboard. Verse 19, on the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands. So it would have been very common for sailing vessels to carry a great deal of extra tackle, sails, or pulleys, or ropes, or all sorts of equipment for your journey. So they started throwing all that overboard, trying to make the ship as light as possible. Verse 20, now when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. So because of the darkness of the storm, because of such crazy scenarios that we're in with this storm, they couldn't see the sun or the stars, which means they couldn't get their position. They couldn't chart where they were at. They're probably floating adrift, not knowing where they're at. And that starts to wane on people. You know, that starts, no doubt there'll be a pessimistic attitude amongst the crew, amongst the people that are on there, amongst the many passengers or the other prisoners that are mentioned. And so as it says here, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. You know, they were gradually stripped away of all their hope of being saved. You know, maybe Paul's thinking, I don't know what he's thinking, but, you know, many of the different people are thinking, there's no hope. We're not going to be saved from this. This is a crazy storm, and I can't believe we left the port that we were in. In verse 21, but after long absence from food, then Paul stood in the midst of them and said, men, you should have listened to me and not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss. You know, not necessarily that this Paul is saying, I told you so, you should have listened to me, but instead he's emphasizing that he was about to say something and that he has a relationship with God and understands things that are going to happen. He was emphasizing to them that God had given him certain information about the voyage, because he begins to talk about a message he receives from God. So no doubt during this whole time, Paul is praying to God, taking time to communicate with God, to ask for, you know, protection, not only for himself, but no doubt the other crew members as well. In verse 22, he says, "And now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship." So Paul has this information from God. He's encouraging that I've gotten this message, you know, that nobody will die, that all of our lives will be saved. Because lives were typically lost during shipwrecks. You know, this would have been a very encouraging thing to hear. Maybe some would be skeptical. I probably would be skeptical in the moment if I didn't have that relationship with Paul, if I didn't even know who the guy was. But he seems to be building this rapport with them, talking about not sailing before they start. And then when they get into this moment, he's saying, we should have listened to my warning. You know, this I knew this was going to happen in a sense. But here he says, verse 23, "For there stood by me this night an angel of God, of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve." It's interesting to note that God didn't send this angel at the beginning of the travels. He waited till everything kind of got to the heat of the moment, kind of through all these trials and all these different difficulties, when they hit this big northeastern wind and everything. That's when God sends this angel or this message, and has a message for Paul, saying in verse 24, "Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you." You know, maybe Paul was praying to God for protection for the other men. And that could be why God is granting him those who sail with him. You know, he's giving them this assurance that nobody's going to die. That's a low probability through all this wrecking and all the shipwrecks, that nobody would die. Surely people on board don't know how to swim. You have a bunch of prisoners, maybe they don't know how to swim. They're thinking, I'm not going to make it out of here. You got people chained to people, maybe. Some prisoners with their captors or their guards, maybe that's a thing or a situation. They could be afraid of dying, but he gives some encouragement. He tries to encourage them. It's interesting that it says, God has granted you all those who sail with you. He's graciously given you, is what this phrasing is talking about. Giving you as a favor. You know, he's giving Paul a favor that he's going to save these other men as well. Verse 25, "Therefore take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told to me." No doubt some would have been skeptical, but others would have been encouraged by Paul's confidence in this. Because he was confident about the storm before they left. They see the type of relationship he has with his guards. Something's different about Paul, no doubt. And so people would have been encouraged by this. And they would start to recognize God's hand in this when Paul's words would come to pass. Verse 26, "However, we must run aground on a certain island." Like I mentioned before, running aground on certain islands or different times would have been a very dangerous thing. Especially during a storm, your ship would most likely be ripped apart if you ran aground. Because you're not going to be able to move, it's going to be a lot of stress on the wood. So that would most likely get ripped apart, and then you'd have a lot of loss of life. Verse 27, "Now when the 14th night had come, as we were driven up and down in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors sensed that they were drawing near some land." Most people would gather that this means 14 days in this little period on your map, if you look, from the island of Crete as they're kind of traveling down here towards Africa. So we've arrived at a 14 days in that storm, kind of just floating around in the storm. But they perceive that they're getting close to some land. They could have heard some sound of some surf or different things, saw some different changes in the waves. Maybe they saw different, you know, I don't know if you've been on lakes or rivers or stuff in a boat or messing around. You can see when there's little sandbars underneath the land. But if it's still really deep, you can still see changes in currents and flow patterns because of the land that's underneath it. Either way, they perceived that they were getting close to some land. It's interesting. If you look on your map, it says Adriatic Sea. You guys see this sea up here between Italy and... You see that up there, Adriatic Sea? That seems to be a mistake in translation in some of the text. like New King James, King James, that kind of kept it around. Other translations refer to it a little better in the as the Sea of Adria. There's good sources that state that the Sea of Adria would fit better with this idea, and that this whole region was referred to as the Sea of Hadrian or Adrian at the time. So not necessarily the Adriatic Sea up north, but still down here south by Africa. It's a name referred to an area extending well south of Italy, an area bounded by Malta, Italy, Greece, and Crete. So this map seems to be a pretty good idea of the travel route, and a lot of scholars agree with that translation. Verse 28, and they took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms. And when they had gone a little farther, they took soundings again and found it to be 15 fathoms. So we see here that they're getting the depth of the water. Soundings is a term that refers to trying to find the depth of the water that you're in. I don't know how they would have done this. Maybe they would have thrown some type of rope over with some type of heavy object on it to measure the depth. But nevertheless, it says found 20 fathoms. They've gone a little farther, and they found 15 fathoms. A fathom is about 6 feet. So the depth was decreasing from 120 feet, which can be really shallow for a big ship, down to 90 feet. It's good to note that there's no real shallow spots in the Mediterranean except in areas near land. So they knew that they had been approaching some type of land. Yeah, Zoe? How much was it? What? About 6, yeah, if not exactly 6. Okay, verse 29. Then fearing lest we should run aground on the rocks, they dropped 4 anchors from their stern and prayed for day to come. You see, at least in the daytime, they could have at least tried to figure out a way to run the ship aground as best as possible, or they could have seen their way to the land a little bit easier, hopefully trying to preserve life. So they put out their anchors, and they tried to get the ship to stay where it was at. Verse 30, and as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, when they had let down their skiff into the sea under pretense of putting out anchors from the prow. So I believe that they're coming up to the front. This is a horrible diagram of a ship. But say this is the front of the ship. I think they're coming up here to try to lower anchors down in the front. That was their pretense of what they were trying to do. Instead, they were trying to lower down that lifeboat and try to escape. These are the sailors. So these are the ones that knew what they were doing. These are the ones that would have been controlling the ship. And here it says that they were under the pretense of sending down anchors in front of the ship. So whether or not they were actually doing that, or if they were just trying to hide that concept, and Paul knows what's going on, Paul sees them and he goes and confronts them. Because if the conditions would have been too severe, there could have been thoughts if they put anchors down too much in the front, it could sink the ship, right? Pull the ship down in front if the wind brings them that way. But nevertheless, Paul seems to see through their ruse, and he comes up and talks to them in verse 31. It says, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Because without the sailors, they wouldn't have had the ability to guide the ship around. Those were the people that knew what was going on. They wouldn't be able to bring it close enough to shore. So then in verse 32, then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the skiff and let it fall off. Most likely the centurion gave the orders to cut the boat off, not that these sailors just did it of their own volition. Most likely the centurion gave the orders for this action. And that's an interesting little tidbit because it seems to show a relationship between the centurion and Paul. Centurion's definitely starting to believe more and more of what Paul is saying. He's got this good relationship with him. He's showing good examples to him. And Paul's statements are seeming to come to be true. So the centurion heeds Paul's warning, and he seems to order them to cut the boat off. Verse 33. Did I skip a verse? No, okay. As the day was about to dawn, Paul implored them all to take food, saying, today is the 14th day that you have waited and continued without food and eaten nothing. You know, the storm had been too violent, for it had been too impossible to prepare food through this time. Verse 34, therefore I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival, since not a hair will fall from your head of any of you. And when he said these things, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. So God would still save them. That was what was promised. But it seems they still had to do their part. You know, they had to eat food. They had to take on their nourishment since they had a little break. But no matter what their situation was, Paul was determined to give God the credit. That's the amazing part, right? No matter what's going on through this whole thing, Paul takes the bread, he breaks it, and he gives thanks to God in front of all these people. You know, I can't imagine exactly how this all played out, but nevertheless, he thanks God and he gives credit to God for saving them. And he's giving thanks to them in a situation that most would just think God's not in this situation. You know, a lot of people would forget about God during this time. But nevertheless, Paul is determined to give credit to God for saving them. Because most were sure they wouldn't survive until daylight. So they were all encouraged, it says in verse 36, then they all were encouraged and also took food themselves. And this is a remarkable example of the positive impact some person can have on others. Because there's no doubt about it that people would have been very negative in this situation. I probably would have been thinking, I'm about to die, this storm is crazy, but just enough encouragement from somebody else, some positivity from somebody else can help others in their time of need. Verse 37, and in all we were 276 persons on the ship. So I alluded to this a little earlier. This would have been a big ship, 276. Some text, some of the scrolls and some of the old texts do seem to indicate maybe this is only 76 people, but a lot of texts do support 276. Josephus, you guys are familiar with his name, he writes and records of a similar trip around the similar time frame, through the similar route, that would have been carrying 600 people. So there's no doubt that ships could have carried that many people. And so it seems to be the body of evidence that supports 276. That seems to be the right number. Josephus writes of a transport, like I said, in 63 AD, so about the same time frame. Verse 38. So when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and threw out the wheat into the sea. So it was completely obvious that they weren't going to be able to salvage what they had on the ship. So they took and they ate and they were encouraged, but they threw the rest in the sea, hoping to lighten it up before running aground, potentially maybe getting further up on the shore. Verse 39, when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they observed a bay with a beach, onto which they planned to run the ship if possible. And they let go the anchors and left them in the sea, meanwhile losing the rubber ropes. And they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. So they let go. So they cut the ropes holding those different things. They threw those guys in the sea. So they're kind of just abandoning all these different things that they have. You know, they're trying to make, this is their effort. They're trying to make it to the shore. They're trying to run this ship aground. And it's interesting, this is some of the details I was talking about at the beginning. You know, these are details that most would leave out of stories, but Luke is so detailed and that interesting perspective, he just leaves some of these details in here that a lot of people would have just overlooked. So verse 41. But striking a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the prow struck fast and remained immovable, but the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. So Luke says a place where two seas met. So this is most likely a sandbar. So if you've ever been on a sandbar on a river or a lake, you know, I come from North Dakota, where the Missouri River is pretty clean. It's the start of the Missouri River. We used to go on the river all the time. And our sandbars, if you've ever been on them, they look like giant seas on the outside of them, right? You have a little bit of land, but you have sea all around you. So that's what Luke is describing here. It's a sandbar with deep water on either side. And so it says they ran the ship aground. The prow stuck fast. I believe the prow is the front of the boat, but the stern was being broken up with the violence of the waves. So either way, one part of the boat is shoved up on the sand, but the other one's just being broken apart by the violence of the waves. Verse 42, and the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away and escape. All right, so why would the captors plan to kill their prisoners? I'll just ask a question here. So we've talked about this a little bit. Andrew? Yeah, very, very, yeah. It's according to Roman law. I think the punishment would have been the punishment for the escape, the prisoner escaping. So I don't know what the punishment would be, often death in a lot of instances. But if the soldier that had the prisoner, if his prisoner escaped, he would be punished with that punishment of the escaping prisoner. So their plan was, instead of any of them escaping, we're just going to kill them so they can't get away. So that was a little bit of way they could save their own skin, if you would. But verse 43, but the centurion, wanting to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land. It's interesting because the centurion was taking a pretty great chance here. You know, he wanted to save Paul. We can see this relationship building. There seems to be some close concept here. The centurion definitely started believing Paul, and he wants to save him. So he commands that none of them kill him, but instead those that could swim, they jump overboard first, swim to land. So he's taking a great chance that some people could escape. And he would have paid for his life if he had been wrong. That's something to keep in mind. So it's an interesting concept we see of this centurion, this guy named Julius, that we don't know a whole lot about, but he seems to be taking these great chances relying on Paul and Paul's great example. Verse 44, and the rest, some on boards and some on parts of the ship, and so it was that they all escaped safely to the land. That's kind of how the chapter closes out, with this remarkable story about this journey that starts through the Mediterranean Sea and this crazy storm that they get impacted with. And so no doubt that a lot of the sailors probably could have swam. They probably jumped over first, but a lot of people probably couldn't. And so they were saved, floating on different parts of the ship or different crates, different things that would have been on there. Any questions as we've gone through chapter 27? Or questions about the map since we passed that out at the beginning?
Sabrina? What made them need to go at this time of year if it was so dangerous and not normally done?
Yeah, what made them go?
Yeah, maybe I missed that.
Yeah, I guess maybe I don't know off the top of my head of any preceding scriptures that talk about the reason. I know that he's going through this whole process of, going through the Roman court systems. And if you remember, I know it's before the break, but maybe we could go there. Yeah, verse 32 of chapter 26, he's kind of appealing to Festus and King Agrippa. And King Agrippa says to Festus, this man might have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. So maybe there's an aspect of Roman law that there's a certain time frame that he has to get to Caesar. I didn't look up that off the top of my head. But he seems to have, he's invoked his right as a citizen, and he's got to appeal to Caesar. Micah?
I don't remember which class it was. Probably this one. But I thought we were told like he most likely went before Caesar, but we don't actually, obviously it's not recorded like his interaction with Caesar, but the way I heard it was he probably went before Caesar, but with Caesar being busy and him being kind of a minute prisoner, he might not have gone. But then when Paul says the angel said, you must appear before Caesar, shouldn't we take that as absolute fact, like he had to have?
I guess I would. Off the top of my head. I don't know who you're referring to or what class you're referring to that we may have said he didn't.
It might have been this one. It's not that he didn't, but I guess it was just like there's a possibility since we don't have it exactly recorded, but wouldn't that count as having it recorded that he absolutely did make it and appeal to Caesar himself?
I guess I can't think of an interpretation where it wouldn't mean that, so I think I agree with you. There's an earlier quote in chapter 23, I believe. There's a quote there in verse 11 where it says, chapter 23 and verse 11, but the following night the Lord stood by him and said, be of good cheer, Paul, for you have testified of me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome. Maybe the comment was made around that same scripture, because it doesn't say Caesar there, it just says Rome. So maybe that was an offhand comment. I guess I don't know, but that's a good question. I would agree with you, though, about the statement that you have to appeal to Caesar. I guess the only other thought would be, could be a title, so you just appear to his administration or his court. I don't know how Roman law works either in that specific sense. But good question. Any other thoughts? Questions? Statements? I don't think we'll go further. I didn't bring any notes for chapter 28.